So today we are going to do special shir in anticipation of Yom HaShoah. This is always a difficult shir for me personally, having lost a pretty substantial percentage of family in the Holocaust. There are two sheets that are going around. I already want to apologize for handing around anything to Shira that has Wikipedia on it. I checked the information. It's actually accurate as far as I can tell. Wikipedia actually does quite well in comparative studies, but yes, it is not an academic resource in quite that way, but I do want to use it. What I want to do today is as follows. I'd like to introduce a character, a story of someone who is increasingly becoming one of my personal heroes. I haven't been fully exposed to his character, but I'm just starting to gain greater exposure. I already have some. And the more that I learn about him, the more inspired I am by his heroism, by his leadership during a very dark time in Jewish history. And his name is Rav Kalanimus Kalman Shapiro. Rav Kalanimus Kalman Shapiro is also known as the Eish Kodesh. The Eish Kodesh, the Holy Fire. You have a picture of him in the front. That's he. And just this past year, there's a brand new book that was published, and this shiur is based on that book. I read it over Chag, it came just before Yom Tov, and it was very happy reading over Yantif, but I was preparing this shiur. And the truth is, it's tragic, but it's also inspiring. Torah from the Years of Wrath, the historical context of the Eish Kodesh, I'll explain in a second, by someone by the name of Dr. Henry Ibbinson, whom I know. He's a historian who is a dean at Touro. And what he did is as follows. I'll give you a little bit of the background, explain to you what we're going to do over the course of this shiur. I'll explain to you what he was doing based on a little bit of the history, based on a little bit of the background. And we will do our best with the background noise. Sorry, we're doing our best. I think all the windows are closed. Yeah, for sure. Take it. Send it around. Little show and tell. Essentially as follows. So you know who he is. Rav Kalanimus Kalman Shapiro is known as the Piazetzner Rebbe. Okay, the Piazetzner Rebbe. How to spell that is the subject of probably any number of different spellings that are not in Yiddish. But be that as it may, the Piazetzner, which is the town that he and his family was from, and that he was the Zion of the of that Hasidic leadership, and he became the Hasidic Rebbe of the Piazetzners. He himself, as we'll describe, was someone who lived during the time of the Warsaw Ghetto, and he was actually there with a number of his Hasidim. And over the course of the time from the beginning of World War II, when the ghetto was bombed, through a few months before the liquidation of the ghetto, he was active in the ghetto. Tragically, he was ultimately murdered in 1943. He was sent to the Czarnecki concentration camp, and he was murdered there on November 3, 1943. And I'll go through his history, and we're going to do some of the history of the ghetto. But there's an unbelievable story behind all of this. And basically, the story that precipitated the publication of a series of sermons that he delivered in that ghetto, or in Warsaw in general, including in the ghetto, once it became a ghetto, essentially goes as follows. In 1950, there was a Warsaw worker, just a Polish worker, who discovered a tin milk can. Mm-hmm. And he had no idea what he had bumped into, and he again went to Jewish historians ultimately, and it turns out that this was a cachet, it was a stash of intentionally hidden materials that were buried by historians, some of which were professional historians before the war, some of which were amateur historians before the war, who actually buried the, this canister, this milk can, tin milk can, in order to preserve historical documentation of what happened in Warsaw over the course of the war. They had a secret name. The society was, interestingly enough, called Oneg Shabbat, okay? The joy of Shabbat, which is surely a euphemism, okay? But the idea was that they, I think a part of the idea was, I don't know the actual reasoning for the name that they chose. It was, on one hand, euphemistic, clearly, right? There's not much oneg to go around in the Shabbatot or any other part of the experience of that community at that time. But I think, I suspect that part of it may have been that Shabbat is me'in olam haba. Shabbat anticipates the world to come. And they wanted to give the tragic memory of that which had unfolded in Warsaw to give it eternity. And so that was really their goal, to preserve this documentation. They discovered this canister had all sorts of historical documentation, and among them, they figured out that they had a series of manuscripts, including the sermons, about 100 serms that the Piazetzer had delivered in Warsaw during the war to his Hasidim. He did not give them any interesting sort of title. He gave them, called them, sermons that were delivered in the Hebrew years, you know, 5700, 5701, 5702. But that was pretty much all he called them. They were published in 1960 under the title of Welcome to My New Life, My New World. The steel's all up, by the way. So it's very exciting, but it comes with some trade-offs. I think all the windows are all closed, right? Did we double check? I believe
they're
they are.
Right, and it's just, what? It doesn't matter if they're closed.
It doesn't matter. They're going to be here.
Right,
you know, I had a really nice view at one point, so I just want to say that for the record. We took pictures beforehand. Do you know we have a camera on the roof that's taking time-lapse pictures of the construction?
Oh,
nice. Yeah, we have. We're getting everything. It's very, very cool. We'll use that for video purposes. That's literally just 24/7. It's going, and we put in a new battery pack every month or two. So you gotta go up to the attic, and you gotta make sure that it's working properly.
Mischief during the night.
Right. We're worried about the thefts have taken place mostly in the building, not outside. For those who are in the know. Anyhow, so they discovered a number of manuscripts, and among them was these sermons. In 1960, these sermons were published under the title of Esh Kodesh, which is Esh Kodesh, the holy sacred fire, the fire of martyrdom, the fire of destruction of the Warsaw community, of the Holocaust generation. That was part of it, but also Esh Kodesh for the passion of the Piazetzner, which we'll see will come through, and I'll explain a little bit about his biography in just a few moments when we circle back. Let me just finish this. Republished in 2007 under the same title. Turns out that the manuscripts, as we'll see, were almost impossible to decipher. You can actually look now. I'll show it to you right here. If you take a look, most of what we have here is English translations of select sermons that I copied from this book. All this is photocopied from this book. At the bottom left, you have actually what a little historian by the last name of Dov Devani, who discovered, and then he did a lot of the work publishing working on this material. He actually described this in 1961 at the Eichmann trials. He said, the staff is on the left side of that side. The staff of the Jewish Historical Institute helped me, but to no avail. One day when I decided to search further, suddenly they brought me a will which had been found amongst these documents. In other words, in this tin can from Oneg Shabbat of Rabbi Kalanimus Shapiro in favor of his brother in the land of Israel, the late Rabbi Yeshaya Shapiro, and two other disciples who are living today in Israel. And notice the date, which was 4 months before the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt. Okay, that's when they decided, they realized the Nazis are going to liquidate the ghetto. They understood by that point that the final solution had been developed and was beginning to be implemented. They knew the ghetto was all but over, so they decided now is the time, we have to bury this material. I became very excited and began reading, and I saw he put into the can books which he had written during the war years. This is what he actually found, the bottom left. It's in Yiddish prose. You can see just how easy to read the handwriting of the Piazetzner was. He was brilliant, but clear handwriting he was not known for. You will see in the third line, though, for example, you see it's on their brackets there at the beginning of the third Hebrew line. They're hard to make out. And then right after that, there's a quotation mark at the bottom, in Hebrew sometimes at the bottom, and it says Tzav Vezeros. Do you see that?
Yes.
Tzav Vezeros was the title of his personal diary, which was one of the books that he buried in here. We actually have his own description, and we'll see just how powerful some of that was. And then it says, Chidushei Torah. He has, and then he goes on, he describes it again in Yiddish, he gives the title. In some, we have his personal diary, we have a number of his novella, Chidushei Torah, and we have a number of other books that he wrote as well, which we'll describe in a moment, which was all found in this cache. And you can see the English translation on the right side. We can actually read it together. Blessed is God, I have the honor of requesting the esteemed individual or institution that finds enclosed writings, Achsharat Ha'avrechem, Mivo Ha'Sharim, which is an introduction to students. Those are both books that were meant for advanced students to inspire them religiously and in their development as young Hasidic religious individuals. Tzav Vezeros, which was that diary I mentioned. Torah Insights on the Weekly Readings in the years 5757, 01, 5702. That's Eish Kodesh. That's what we're going to be looking at today. To please exert themselves, send to the land of Israel following address, or Rishai Shapiros, that's his brother, when the Blessed One will show mercy, and I and the remaining Jews survive the war. Tragically, of course, we know that did not pass. Please return all materials to me or to the Warsaw Rabbinate for Kalanimus. May God have mercy upon us, our Israel, in every place, and rescue us, sustain us, and save us in the blink of an eye. Deep heartfelt gratitude. Kalanimus. This is a man who was revered by his Hasidim and was known as one of the great Hasidic pre-war leaders, simply signing Kalanimus, which is a sign of his humility, which we see throughout. This is an amazing story. If you want to get a sense as to just how hard it was to transcribe the manuscript, if you look at the next page, you will see copies. Some of it was written by him. Some of it was written by his scribe with his own annotations. He, over the course of the years in Warsaw, unfortunately, he had some spare time. And so he, instead of twiddling his thumbs, he actually wrote up all of the drasha. The sermons were overwhelmingly given on Shabbat and Yom Tov. So he, here the scribe, wrote them up. And then he would add annotations. Sometimes he would add comments or even revert on what he had said. Like he said something softer in the first years in Warsaw. And then he had something a little bit more painful to say 2 years later, like that, because things really shifted. They published based on this manuscript in 1960, and then republished in 2007. The original version. Turns out, because the manuscript was so difficult and technology was not yet fully developed, that the manuscript had all sorts of errors that had crept into it. There's a Dr. Daniel Reiser who last year published a critical edition with thousands of revisions. And it's brand new. I have not gotten my hands on the actual new Hebrew text yet, but I just learned about it when I read this over Pesach, so I haven't gotten it yet. This entire book is based on the edited, excellent manuscript work that was done by this scholar in Israel, this Dr. Daniel Reiser. Questions or comments before we continue? All right, so what I want to do is three things. I want to say another word or two about who he was before the war. I want to look a little bit at the background of the Warsaw Ghetto. And then what I want to do is to look at some of these sermons, just to give a sense. What this book seeks to accomplish is really something, the book that's going around, Terror from the Years of Wrath, Dr. Abramson, is groundbreaking. What had happened previously is that the drushos were delivered and were published. But if you look carefully, as opposed to some other wartime drasha, there are very few that have survived, but he only deals in allusion to the historical events of that era. Overwhelmingly, here and there, he refers to a certain action by the German, and so on and so forth, but overwhelmingly, it's almost as if it's maybe because it's Shabbos, so it's in Yontif, and he doesn't want to destroy the atmosphere. Maybe it's a psychological tactic because it's so overwhelming for everyone, right? And it's not going to help anyone to describe explicitly what was going on. Maybe it is, a way of sort of a literary style of almost transcending the tragedy on the ground to say there's something elevating us, which is the Torah, which can go beyond just, it can take our tragic experience, but do something more than that. Very powerful style. But what that meant was that you didn't necessarily know exactly what he was referring to. Like, you read the drashos and you're like, there's something horrible happening, but we don't know what. What we now, though, have is we have a critical edition of the sermons together with other, not only his own diary, which we've had since 1950, but also new diaries that we found from the leader, of the Jewish community of Warsaw at that time, as well as other diaries. And so now we have a timeline of the Warsaw Ghetto, right, or the Warsaw community, and then the ghetto, and we can literally date, every sermon is dated overall. So what Dr. Abramson did, he's a historian, he matched up the dates and the sermons, and, what he does is he explains the context. He doesn't explain every single one because it's a popular work, he's not going to do 100 of them, but I would say he does about probably 40 or so sermons that he goes through in this book, and he goes, just says, this is what was happening, this is what the Pizetzer is clearly referring to.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And it's very, very powerful, and it's really breakthrough historical work. And it is intense, but because of the nature of the more elevating, it's tragic, don't get me wrong, but it's not like, because he's not actually describing the events, it feels somehow a little bit easier to assimilate than if he said, this week they shot so-and-so in the street. Like, it's not, you know, that's what was happening, but that's not what he's, there's no need for him to say, because everyone knows what's happening. That's all anyone's talking about in the ghetto.
To a new context. So what you're saying, they knew probably what was all the horror stuff that was going on.
They didn't need him to break the news,
exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
They needed him for rabbinic inspiration and commentary.
Exactly.
I'm not going to even draw comparisons to today's news cycles because it's so much above that. But like everyone knows.
They needed him for Kizug and to hold the community together.
That's exactly
that's
right.
What he did.
And sometimes to just simply to give empathy.
Yeah.
But not by saying, God is with you in your suffering, or simply by saying, the Torah describes this. Not to say it's, God forbid, justified, just to simply say the Torah gives us a description of exactly what you're undergoing. The Tochat, you know, we'll see one with the Tochat Sedra. We'll see it's worse than that because there was personal tragedy as well. And that's going to be a piece of it. So that's exactly what's happening. So again, what I want to do is quickly say a few words about him, his philosophy, just a few more words. Then I want to look quickly at the timeline of the Warsaw Ghetto, and then I want to look at some of these sermons in actual translation. I chose about 8 partial translations for us. So even that's going to be a stretch for today. I'll get through what we can in those highlights, but it's, you know, feel free to order the book. It's available on Amazon. You can. It was very powerful reading, and I find it very moving, and I want to go back now to read all of Esh Kodesh and all of his stuff. He's really remarkable. There's a shul in Woodmere called Congregation Esh Kodesh, which is named after the Pizetzner. I mean, his writing is incredibly inspired, and you'll see in a few ways here. All right, so let's do a little bit more of his own background, and then we'll go from there. So we'll talk about him during the war, but who was he before the war? I think this is really important background. So he was born in 1889, okay? And he's murdered, as we said, 1943. Okay, so he lives in roughly 54 years. And he, again, is a scion of the Hasidic community. He's named after his maternal great-grandfather, who's known as the Maor Vashemesh, Enlightenment and Sun, who himself was a great Hasidic thinker, is a major player. If you've heard of names like the Chose of Lublin, Urveli Melech of Lizhansk, the Magid of Kuznets, these are in Hasidic circles. These were like some of the great personalities. He is born the day after Lag BaOmer in Hasidic circles, bonfires. Lag BaOmer is considered to be a major holiday. It's treated as the yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, to whom the Zohar is attributed. So there's like these Kabbalistic associations with the day of his birth, the day of his circumcision also had certain Hasidic significances. I mean, he's really living within a Hasidic worldview where these kinds of things and these kinds of dates are really very much valued. Tragically, at the age of 3, his father, the Hasidic Rebbe himself, passes away. So he becomes, you know, they don't immediately, it's not like one of those.
Okay.
right? None of the right? Not even North Korean type stuff. Until many, many, many infinite times over. But he does. By the way, there's the face reading in Tanakh is Ben Shoals, right? Ben Shmonel Malchal. Anyhow, so you have these kinds of things. But he is the heir apparent. He is the heir apparent, and he will become declared the Hasidic Rebbe for his community at age 20. So that's still, you know, relatively young. But they also married relatively young back in the day. He married at age 16, which is actually not all that young for that time, because 13 was not uncommon in that day and age. So the ripe old age of 16, and he marries into another very, you know, he's got all the yichas. He's got, like, in all the milas. His wife is Rachel Chaya Miriam. She, I don't think there's enough research on her to give a class on her, but she's very interesting because she was considered to be very knowledgeable and a sort of a scholar in her own right. She's one of these born into a very traditional family who was an autodidact. She helped him write some of his svarim or transcribe some of his svarim. It's almost like learning about Rashi's daughter, her Siyam daughter, you know, that kind of scenario. Again, we don't know too much about him, but one thing about the Piaz Esser that's very interesting is that he has a long family history of highly educated women relative to Hasidic circles. In general, in Hasidic circles, women had even sometimes weaker educations, if that were possible, than in more Litvisha circles or non-Hasidic Jewish circles. So there's a whole piece here to him that his wife was very knowledgeable, and then he wrote about the importance of women's education in a relatively progressive way. I don't want to, you know, say that he was like, you know, even like Rav Soloveitchik, and he like implemented the first Gemara curriculum pre-war. That would be totally anachronistic and inaccurate. But there was a sense of that it was in his family, and that he married into it as well. They had two children, Elimelech ben Sion, Rachel Yehudis. They both perished in the Shoah. We'll hear more about that soon. 1909, as I said, he's 20. He's appointed the Rebbe of Piazetsna, which is near Warsaw. He attracts many Hasidim. In 1923, he establishes a yeshiva, so that's at the age of 34, a little bit later on, became one of the largest Hasidic yeshivos between the wars. Now, just some context, it's very, very important here. What's happening to the observant community at this time between the two world wars? How's it faring, would you say?
It's breaking up.
Oh, you got this. There's utter devastation. I don't mean, like, in terms of the physical state of the Jews, and that's a complicated thing as well. It's depression everywhere. The assimilation is rampant. Yeah. And sometimes we have this, like, quixotic image of the ghetto, you know, the shtetl, rather,
and
all that.
The people of the shtetls were moving into the cities.
Right. You have, I mean, right, just watch Fiddler on the Roof. You get just a taste of this. I mean, tradition, right? You know, and it ends with intermarriage. I mean, these were very, very real problems during this time period. And the Piaz Esser becomes not only actively involved in educating young Hasidic men in particular, starting these yeshivos. He encourages them. He writes books for them. He has a classic book. His best known book is called Chuvat HaTalmidim, The Obligation of Students. The first chapter is actually written to parents and educators with directives for them. The rest of the book is for, basically, is a religious book for teenagers. This other book that we read in the about Hacharat HaRechem is basically the next step. It's like, it's after you read Chuvat HaTalmidim as a teen. Now you read it like in your, you know, late teens and early 20s kind of thing. So it's trying to give religious guidance to them. And he builds young Jewish societies of young men who are going to get together and commit themselves to religious growth. It's like little secret societies, you know, like underground. They had to go underground to grow religiously because they were now in the minority. This might sound familiar, right? If you grow up in a very secularized kind of environment, which is exactly what they were going through, and socialism, and communism, and Zionism, and none of these were pro-religion, and all sorts of radical movements rising up, he builds these groups of what he calls B'nai Aliyah, children of ascent. He writes a book for his chassidim and his these young men as well, called Bnei Machashava Tova. That's another one of his extant works. Bnei Machashava Tova, the children of good thinking. That's a double entendre, as Ish Kodesh is as well. What's that? That's, well, think good thoughts, right? It's not pixie dust stuff. It's think good thoughts. It's number one, how to remain committed and to be religiously inspired and praise chassid, prayer in particular, but learning also is very into both davening and learning Torah, but it's something else. It's also chassidic meditations during and before prayer. It's B'nai Machshava Tova, it's popularizing what were previously esoteric, meditations. He would teach them, walk them through the process of how to be connected to the divine during this. So very interesting practices. He's not only encouraging his chassidim to grow, but he's doing something else. He is giving it, and I mean giving it, to the rabbis of his day. He writes out scathing commentary publicly. And I mean publishing. I mean talking from the pulpit. I mean talking to anyone and everyone he can about, and talking to them also. He's not just like, writing open letters, but he's giving it to the rabbis of the day. And he's saying, guys, your yeshivos may still have students in them, but I got news for you. The only religious Jews left are the ones who are enrolling in your yeshivas. And you know what's happening to 90-something percent of the Jewish population of the next generation? You're losing them. You know what you're doing? You're sitting on your loins. You're like, oh, look, we have such dedicated talmidim who are sitting around our tables, who are so excited to be learning Torah and to be growing. And, and he's writing this to the Litvisher Rabbanim, to the Hasidic Rebbes, and it doesn't matter. Right, at this point, they have a common cause, right? So that wasn't the major debate of the day. He's like, you guys are missing the boat. The rest of them are all assimilating, and you guys are sitting over here, and you're like giving these like lumdish shiurim, and you're giving all this like highfalutin stuff, and you know what? They're quote unquote driving cars on Shabbos, and as it were, right? The equivalent thereof back in the day, right? These guys are totally assimilating. They're completely cut off from their parents. Like, where are you? You need to develop a religious message that resonates more broadly. You know, so he's ripping the rabbis. And he writes this very explicitly. And he develops a theory of education that is highly progressive. And that first chapter that I mentioned, that book, Kavana Talmidim, he says, you know what the rabbis are also doing? They're cookie, they're cookie cuttering our children. That's what he says. Not exactly in that language, but that's basically what he says. He says, they think chinuch means, right, everyone looks like them. Right? Like, you're all, I always tell my students, right? If you all become little Sinenskys, I've failed. I'm over. I'm done.
He was so far ahead of his time.
It was amazing to read this. This is used in schools nowadays. When we talk about Chanoch Lanar al Pidarko, educate a youth according to one's own path, that there should be individualized, differentiated education. He was screaming this from the rooftops in the very beginning of the 20th century. I mean, more than 100 years ago. And he's saying, or roughly 100 years ago, he's saying this to the rabbis, like, you want all of them to come the same end as you. You know what's going to happen then? You squeeze them all into this narrow mold, right? You're just going to get rebellion. They need to be allowed to cultivate, their own individuality. He says the goal of education is not to tell a student whom to be or what to be. It's to allow a student to grow into him or herself. 100 years ago. Amazing. So inspiring. So, and there are English translations of Kolat HaKamidim as well. And then he talks to the student, and it's like grandfatherish. It's like he's taking them by the hand. And he's like, it's with love. It's unbelievable. So this is his activity before the war. And he's outspoken, he's passionate, but he's loving. He has this compassion about him. It's unbelievable. And then he finds himself in Warsaw, and he has every opportunity to escape, but he does not. And so what happens in the Warsaw, in Warsaw? So we know the basic history, but I just gave a little bit just so that we have the context without having to read everything through.
When you say he has every opportunity to escape, but he doesn't, is that because he doesn't want to leave his flock?
That's what he says. Yeah, and he has multiple opportunities to leave, and he declined every single time they felt they could help him survive, even toward the end, and he said, I'm staying with my Hasidim. He told Hasidim to leave, also. Yeah. He was one of those. He said, you should all leave. But when Hasidim stayed, not everyone was able, but it just didn't work out. He said, I'm not going anywhere.
Was he and his wife together till the end?
They were not together till the end. She was murdered also. She was not murdered at the beginning. I want to say she died later on, but not with him. Around the same time as him? I'm not sure exactly. It's a good question. I don't know. Later. Son and daughter, yeah. We'll see part of that. Yeah, no, it's fine. Anyhow, so I gave you a little bit. We're not going to read too much, especially when I want to keep our eyes on the sermon, but basically a little bit about Warsaw at this time. So we know that the Warsaw Ghetto, I'm just going to read a little bit from here. We know that it was not actually founded as the ghetto until October, November 1940. Okay, so that's he's in Warsaw from the beginning of the war. The war starts, right? War is declared September 1, 1939, right? And they start by attacking Poland. So they're right. The Germans are bombing Warsaw basically from the first week of the war. So he's already there, but the ghetto. So he's there from the transition from when it's a city that's free, that's open, that's then under siege. It's under literally bombing, and then under Nazi control, and then eventually becomes the ghetto, then eventually you have the deportations, etc. Right? In the second paragraph, it gives you the death toll, 300,000 killed by bullet or gas, 92,000 victims of rampant hunger, hunger-related diseases. Typhus was the number one killer in terms of the illnesses in the ghetto. He suffered from typhus, but survived it later on. If you look, in the second paragraph on the next page, the siege of Warsaw continued until from the beginning of the war, right? So September 1, 1939, till September 29th. So it's a four-week siege. September 10 alone is going to be very relevant in a few minutes. The Luftwaffe, that's the German Air Force, conducted 17 bombing raids on the city. 3 days later, 50 German planes attacked the city center. Okay, and that's going to be a tragic moment for his family, and 30,000 people, 10% of the city was destroyed just in those couple of days alone at the beginning of the war. The actual ghetto, you have the outlines of the ghetto on the bottom right. They establish a central government well before the ghetto. There's a Judenrat, which was despised by many of the Jews. At that time, Adam Chernikov is the president the leader of the Judenrat. And you see, again, I don't have time to go through everything, it's not worth it, but you see that it's increasingly difficult. So it's October 26, forced labor is announced. On November 20, the bank accounts, and any deposits exceeding 2,000 zlotys were blocked. November 23, Jewish stars, right? December 1, white armbands. And very importantly for us later, January 26, 1940, no communal prayers due to the risk, get this, of spreading epidemics, right? Because the Jews were, of course, the carriers of disease, which goes back to the Black Plague, which the Jews caused, of course, back in 1350, right? As everyone knew at that time, of course, right? All right, the ghetto wall begins construction April 1, 1940, overseen by the Judenrat itself, which is very complicated. I'm now turning to the next page. October 16, 1940, the creation of the ghetto is officially announced, and so the area constituted only 2.4% of the overall metropolitan area, but contains 30% of the general population. Okay, there were, it depends on what time it was, but there were anywhere between 7.2 and 9.1 people per room in each of the apartments. Not per apartment, per room in the apartments, living at the height of the ghetto. Gives you a little bit here about the administration. Go blame the Jews, right? Go figure, right? By the way, if you go through the history, the rations were at one point a very generous helping of 507 calories a day. And then they finally, you know, decided not, you know, there's no need to be so generous, so they cut it down to 303 calories per day. The way the Jews survive is black market smuggling, and there's like a whole history and literature of that. Let me give you some of the, right, some of it here. In 1941, actually what the average ration for Jews under conditions on the last side was limited to 184 calories, okay? The Poles got 699, that was great. And yes, the Germans got 2,613. Okay, you can read, you get the idea.
600 isn't so much either.
Yeah, right? To say the least, it's just barely enough for subsistence, and 184 is just send them straight to the gas chambers. It's less painful that way, I'm sorry to say. Okay, this is what he lives through. Okay? All right, so now we're going to come to this one. So what I'm going to do is, based on this book, I'm going to give you a little bit of the background of each of the sermons. And then we're going to actually read. Just so you know how this is working, I'm now on the next side. I'm sorry, the page numbers, I realized, didn't often come out in the copies. So we're just going to go through it. I thought they did, but it looks like they didn't. So we're now up to the page that starts on the top left, the Nazis. Okay, next slide. So just so you know how it looks, we're going to mostly be working on the indented sections. The indented sections are the translated sermons, okay? And just we're going to keep on flipping that way. The first one, that sermon that he delivers that we're going to look at was the first recorded drasha in Eish Kodesh. And these are all now, they were published last year in Hebrew. So what Dr. Abramson did over last year is he translated them on his own from the new manuscripts in Hebrew published last year into his own English rendering. So these are all his own translations.
Did he have, or was there any access to Sfarim, to Tanakh, to Gemara, to Mishnah, to Midrash, or was it
at this time, all from memory. That's not true. No, he had a base Midrash. They took them away in like 1940. So it depends on what point during the war. But he had a base medrash, he's a Hasidic base medrash in Warsaw. So initially yes, and then later no.
The Germans took away all the books.
They took away all the books from his base medrash at some point in 1940, I believe. They did burn them. And they did all sorts of interesting things, as we'll see.
So they had to rely on visual to figure out when the Rosh Hashanah was.
They had calendars. Yeah, they had calendars. That wasn't a problem for them.
Right.
You'll see. Sometimes they had to go into hiding, though.
Right.
We'll get there.
Okay.
But most of it's not in hiding. What I mean to say is, most of it is, there's a difference between being secretive and being in hiding.
Right. No,
they had a secret base medrash after, you know, the ghetto started, and there were laws that were passed in October, November, that we just referenced, 1940, and they had to have secret prayer services, and they actually, before Shana and Yom Kippur, they went on secret trip to the mikvah. There's a little harrowing tale about their trip to the mikvah, which is closed down. They were like, it was, you know, a threat of death if you used the mikvah, you know, but at one point they actually had to go into total hiding. Not just for the prayer services, but just so that they wouldn't be killed. So the first one he has is that Dr. Abramson reproduces is the very first recorded drasha. This is dated September 14, 1939. So this is happening, right? This is happening. This is happening on September 14. Yeah, September 14, 1939. This is during the bombings. This is during the bombings. That's when the Shoshana falls out that year. He gives a whole message. One of the things that he does is he invokes a a parable that he comes back to many times over the course of the war. So he says, the city owed taxes to the king and sent out collectors. When the tax collectors approached within 10 mil of the city, so that's a rabbinic mile, not actually a mile, it's a Persian mile, it's less than a mile, the local dignitaries went out and paid homage to the king, and the collectors waived a third of the taxes. Okay, next paragraph. So too, on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the great ones of the generation fast. The Holy One who is blessed waives a third of their sins until the day of Yom Kippur, and the Holy One who is blessed forgives them all. So in other words, what he's doing is he's describing the anxiety of the townspeople who are waiting for the tax collectors to come and to collect their taxes, right? Who are just waiting to pounce on them. That's the language that he uses. And he says that our goal, our what we attempt to do, is to take the anxiety about the tax collector and to turn that heavenward over the course of Rosh Hashanah, Tzom Gedalia, the fast of Gedalia, and then Yom Kippur, with the hope that God will forgive all of our sins on Yom Kippur. That's all he has. Right, that's all he describes. Now, this could have been a sermon that he gave before the war, right? I mean, the tax collector could be whom, right? What would it be before the war, right?
The government.
Right? Could have been the government. Who else could have? Just in general, like, just the anxiety, and there were economic issues, right? Germany was depressed, but not only Germany, right? There was a mass depression after World War I. That was certainly affecting it was a thriving community, relatively speaking, but still, right? There was definitely economic anxiety for the Jewish community. There's no question about that, too. Right? What else could this have referred to? To God himself. Right? I mean, there's just anxiety. The tax collector, right, is God who's coming to, you know, is an accounting that's going to be made in the high holiday season. But September, right, September 14, 1939, is happening when? We now know. It's 2 weeks after the war was destroyed. When did the bombings of Warsaw start, we said? Right, remember? September 10. Okay, when were they most intense? September 13. Who are the tax collectors? Right? Yeah, it's the Nazi warplanes. Okay? So what he's saying is, we're scared for our lives. Right? We have no idea what's going to be. We're being bombed. The war just started. We don't know what's going to happen. And he says, this message of hope, he says, we can't guarantee, but there's one Savior that we have. We have no control over that. What we can do is turn that anxiety heavenward and turn that to God. And so he gives a message of hope, of first of all, of empathy, first of all, right, or second of all, of a sense of optimism, and third, a framing of the connectivity, of the linkage between the historical moment and those anxieties that go along with it, and hope for the future. That's a more relatively uplifting or optimistic sermon, but now we appreciate the sort of the intensity of that moment. He continues, if you go to the next page, he says, the essence of fear is derived from the greatness of God. Every Jewish soul feels this, each person according to his ability. Thus, whereas one person might feel within himself the fear of the greatness and holiness of God and tremble with a thought, heaven forbid of sinning against God, another person might merely feel the fear of punishment, right? Which we now understand, right, says Dr. Abramson, right? Divine punishment comes in all sorts of forms, and sometimes, yeah, aerial bombings might be the form of punishment. Of course we're feeling the fear of punishment. And then he gives a parable that he comes back to many times in his writing. He cites his father's work, Imre Elimelech, which cites this parable. Prince is held captive among wanton people who torment him. And we now know, right, who the new the new meaning of this ancient parable. When he suddenly senses the king is close by, that's God, he begins to shriek bitterly, "Save me, my father, save me, my king." He cries because he senses that the king is near. The intensification of his plaintive cries is an indication of the king's greater proximity. So too when a Jew is brokenhearted, whether over his own troubles, the suffering of his loved ones, or Jewry as a whole, it is a sign that he senses the revelation of the sovereignty of heaven. All this, however, is dependent on the intensification of his fear of the Blessed One, his repentance, desire to coronate the Blessed One as his king. What's the religious messaging now in the same sermon? In the first recorded sermon in Eish Kodesh, he says, anxiety can be channeled to be something healthy. He says the anxiety of the enemy can be anxiety about God himself. Okay, and that can be used toward a higher religious purpose. So he's trying to take it and uplift it.
How do you think this was won over with people?
It's complicated, right?
Very complicated.
Yeah.
I think it's really hard to get there.
Yeah.
To where he's talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
100%. Now remember that he is not giving a mass sermon for the wider community. This is for a self-selected group of Hasidim who were already committed, Piezetzner Hasidim, deeply religious individuals, pious individuals, who were looking for religious inspiration at a time when religious language looked a little bit different than it does today. So for them, and remember, they didn't really know what to make of this moment. So we have no idea. I suspect if you were speaking to a wider audience, it would have looked very different. And the tone shifts over the course of the war. So,
except that sermon, I mean, they kind of remind me of a lot of the like the midrashim in the like Bereishis Rabba, you know, analogous to a king of flesh and blood who, you know,
yeah.
So it draws that.
It's a very traditional.
It's a very traditional way of speaking about the relationship and
yeah.
Between God and people.
Yeah.
And so on. Yeah,
surely. And I think part of what he's trying to do is to say, is to give them that anchor, is to give them some sense of security. Okay, that's the first one I want to look at. 11 days later, tragedy strikes personally. Another German bombing, and this time he loses, his son is hit by a bombing. His son dies three days later on September 28. As they're bringing his son, they went from place to place to find the hospital. As they bring the son to the hospital, the Germans bomb the hospital. His daughter-in-law and son-in-law are killed on the spot. His son dies 3 days later in the hospital. Silence for a month. No drashas. Mourning. There's a later account on the next side. If you look at the next page in the indent, for a time the Hasidim who were with the Rebbe thought he would collapse, though this lasted only a moment. The Rebbe composed himself, recited the verse the Lord gave, and the Lord is taken away from Eov, and directed that the deceased be taken to the cemetery for a eulogy and a burial. The Rebbe was silent for a month. No entries from the weeks after the death of his son are recorded in Torah from the years of wrath. But in his diary, in Savazeros, he does. He says, "Now I sit still and silent. The intensity of pain is beyond bearing. I've broken beyond repair. It was decreed in heaven, a harsh decree, a very bitter one, to take him from me in 5700. The outbreak of the war on the 12th of Tishrei during the bombing. He was mortally wounded. He was standing near me a few days later on the second day of Sukkot, the 16th of Tishrei. Returned his pure and holy soul to his maker. Also at that time, my daughter-in-law, his wife, was killed while standing outside the hospital. That was on the 13th of Tishrei. Her name was Gittel, daughter of Rabbi Shlomo Chaim of Balikov. All hope for myself and my soul, both in this world and the next, was aborted with their premature deaths." This is a Hasidic dynasty. His son, his only son, now can no longer become the next Piezetzner. Right, so there's that. "My own future in them through their continued spiritual growth was also destroyed through me. The tragedy is too great to bear. Only you, God, can sustain and encourage me with your wonders. Please, God, have pity on a poor Jew like me. Have mercy on me, Father, Master. Listen to the petition of my heart, which wallows in pain and sorrow." That's from his diary. 6 weeks later, November 4, the next recorded sermon. This is the next one I want to look at. And turn the page to, at the bottom it says page 80. And he cites his maternal great-great-grandfather, the Maor Vashemesh, and he says something shocking. And scholars, by the way, have tried to trace the theological messages. And the truth is, through the years of the war, they may have evolved. Like, how does he deal with theodicy? There's some meaningful, real good scholarship on that. How does he deal with suffering of the righteous and all of that? And does it shift? Are there stages in his thinking as things get darker during the war? Does he change his approach? Like, does he initially say, well, traditional line of like, you know, we're suffering because of our sins, and then it gets to a point of no return. He's like, you know what? This is something different. This just doesn't fit that paradigm. Some have suggested that, but it also zigzags depending on what's going on. So there may be overall development, but it's not linear, and you see that in this sermon. He writes, is written in the holy work Maor Vashemesh, the beginning of Parshat Va'era. In the name of the holy rabbi, the man of God, our teacher and master, Menachem Mendel, Rimanov, may the memory of the righteous and only be for a blessing. Regarding the Talmudic passage, a covenant is made with salt, and a covenant is made with affliction.